way, lives in the middle of the country and is a conservative Republican. She also loves me and my partner and our daughter and welcomes us with open arms at every family occasion we manage to attend. The few times we've cautiously talked politics, Aunt Lucy has been curious and kind. Aunt Lucy watches Fox News, and eventually it dawned on me that most Fox viewers are probably just like her. Decent, curious about the news, intending to learn and do something good with the information. I started to picture my Aunt Lucy when I would go on Fox, and then when I would go on CNN, and even when I would respond to people on Twitter. It made it easier for me to think and talk and act from a place of kindness, not hate. To not essentialize the invisible people on the other side of those screens, but instead to imagine my Aunt Lucy, someone I love and respect. For me, it's infinitely more encouraging, not to mention more effective, to treat conservatives as a bunch of Aunt Lucys, instead of as a cache of trolls or a basket of deplorables. Nobody's going to engage in a constructive dialogue with me if they think I believe they're a bridge-dwelling gnome or a totable pile of rot. And thinking about my Aunt Lucy helps undercut the dangers of essentialism. People often ask me how they can talk to their conservative relatives at family gatherings like Thanksgiving. I actually have a handy tool taught to me by Matt Kohut and John Neffinger, authors of the book Compelling People, as well as their colleague Seth Pendleton, with whom I've worked leading media trainings and public speaking workshops. Imagine my Aunt Lucy says something about how she doesn't mean to be anti-immigrant or anything, but the economy is just really bad right now and we don't have enough jobs for the people who are already here. Now, my natural instinct is to argue. No, you're wrong, and let me explain the three reasons why. But what we know from neuroscience is that while we all need to use our frontal lobes to engage in reasoned discussion and to be open to persuasion, when we perceive an argument coming, our frontal lobes shut down and the fight-or-flight part of our brain turns on, the part of the brain, as we'll see later, that also holds our biases and stereotypes. If we want to keep the possibility of persuasion open, we have to stay conversational. Also, in her statement, my Aunt Lucy isn't expressing cold, hard facts so much as she's expressing a feeling about the facts as she understands them. And as every good couples counselor I've ever been to has told me, you can't argue with feelings. If my partner says I hurt her feelings, I can't say, no, I didn't. They're her feelings, and they're inherently valid by virtue of her feeling them. So instead of arguing, here's a tip, which uses the shorthand ABC. The A stands for affirm. First, you find a feeling that you can genuinely affirm. In this hypothetical conversation with my Aunt Lucy, I might say, I'm also really worried about the economy right now. Or, I completely agree that it's important everyone has access to a good job. It's important, and I'm not making it up. It's not some actor gesture. I mean it. I can really authentically agree with that part of what Aunt Lucy is saying. So I start with that. Next is B, for bridge. It does not stand for but. It also does not stand for however, which is the Harvard of buts. It's a bridge, a way of saying and. You can actually just say and, or that's why, or actually, or the thing is, or even the good news is. Anything but. But basically invalidates whatever came before. Like when I say to my partner, I'm sorry, but. According to those same couples counselors, that means I'm not at all sorry. Apparently, that's what my partner thinks it means too. Then comes C, convince. This is where I put whatever I was inclined to spit out in the first place about how comprehensive immigration reform actually raises wages and working standards for immigrant and citizen workers, or whatever point I wanted to make. In my experience, ABCing is hard to do in the moment, but incredibly effective when done right. It's a powerful tool for what I call connection speech, which not only lets you make your point, but helps you make it in a friendly, respectful way that can be heard. But beyond the ABC tool, when people ask how to talk to their own Aunt Lucy's about politics, I often ask, how do they talk with their family members about topics other than politics? Do they yell and scream at their aunt if she loves some movie they think is stupid? Of course not. Maybe they get heated and say things like, seriously, you don't think Dirty Dancing is the greatest love story of all time? But the conversation stays civil, and any outrage is secondary to the overwhelming spirit of love. I am not going to disown Aunt Lucy for not liking Dirty Dancing. Obviously, political issues are far more important, but still, I love Aunt Lucy infinitely more than I dislike Donald Trump. Remembering that helps. And frankly, I have plenty of good friends I don't see 100% eye to eye with, but generally think are on my side. What if I only agree with them on 90% of issues, or 60%, or 40%? Where do I draw the line between accepting we just agree to disagree and defining them as monstrous enemies. The thing is, I give my people on my side the benefit of the doubt. Why don't I do that for Aunt Lucy? Or my trolls, for that matter. Of course, my trolls aren't my Aunt Lucy, but they also aren't Donald Trump. We often assume and act as though everyone on a given side is an automatic proxy for the very worst behaving of their side's most extreme examples. Such hyper-partisanship is just another form of attribution bias and essentialism. In fact, one of the most startling things I learned about my trolls is that many of them don't even think of themselves as trolls. Turns out they're not thinking about their trolling much at all. They're just killing time by spewing random gunk into the ether. Here I thought they were being deliberately and even strategically hateful when they're mostly just bored. "Do you think about the impact of your tweets?" I ask Arlington Steve, a 41-year-old attorney from Virginia and another one of my top trolls. Among other things, he told me once when police had been killed, "You've got the blood of those cops on your hands," because I'd criticized systemic police brutality. And then, for added measure, he called me a bitch. "Well, honestly, I kind of figure no one reads or cares," Arlington Steve answers. "I'm just more, I guess, entertaining myself," he adds. "I admit I'll use it to vent, or even sometimes I've been nasty to people, which I regret. Yeah, so pretty much that." Later, he sort of boasts that he has some celebrities following him, and I wonder if he's called any of them a bitch. "Why are you on Twitter?" I ask B. Many Hart, one of my trolls who refuses to talk to me on the phone but then sends me paragraphs back and forth through Twitter's private messaging. "Wait a vent. Kill time between / during classes, layovers, bathroom," B. Many Hart writes back. "Wouldn't notice if Twitter disappeared tomorrow." I ask B. Many Hart another question. "Do you think you're nicer in real life or on Twitter?" "Hopefully everyone's nicer in real life," B. Many Hart replies. We go back and forth a bit. "Everyone's mean on Twitter," he says, "so B. Many Hart is too," explaining, "When in Rome, ma'am." So I ask, "Do you think your behavior online is ever hateful?" "Rude. Inconsiderate. Spiteful. Sometimes," B. Many Hart writes back. "Hateful? No." "You know, when I'm bored, I just read a book or take a walk or eat carbs. I don't start smearing people online. But going back and forth with B. Many Hart and talking to Arlington Steve, I notice my essentialist resentment mounting as I ponder what kind of person, or rather kinds of people, do this sort of thing. And yet, they both apologize to me in our exchanges together. Every coin has two sides. So it turns out, does every human being. I realized I had lumped all my trolls together into a vague image of pinhead residents of dumb fuckistan, completely essentializing them based on stereotypes of right-wingers and stripping them of human complexity. In other words, dehumanizing them. After all, trolls are monsters that live under bridges. Trolls aren't human. But the more I talked to my trolls, the more obvious their complicated and specific humanness became. Linda Likes Bacon has a 24-year-old son who, at the time we spoke, was in rehab for meth addiction. "I just want to see him," she told me. "He seems to be doing really good. He's only got a couple months in, but he's determined to finish, so hopefully this will do the trick." When Linda Likes Bacon said this, suddenly, instead of feeling bad for myself that I was getting trolled, I felt bad for her. Here was a woman I was annoyed at for causing me a tiny bit of suffering, and she was going through so much more suffering of her own. Which I guess was ironic, but mostly just felt sad. It was surprisingly profound to realize that the monsters who were so mean to me online were just ordinary people. That they chuckle and stutter and say, just like I do. That they care that celebrities are following them just like I do. That they don't think anyone pays attention to them, which I worry about too. That they are just imperfect, messy, complicated people, whom I have more in common with than not. Even if I still hate cruise nights, I don't hate my trolls anymore. But the more I learned, the more I did start to hate Twitter. How much is the internet itself responsible for trolling? When the internet was invented, many believed technology would connect the world in fundamentally transformative ways, not just in terms of our ability to watch multilingual porn or buy sneakers from anywhere in the world, but at a more human and humane level. The idea was that having access to stories about rural farmers tending their crops in Mali and videos of children working in factories in Bangladesh would help expand our minds and our circle of compassion to become a truly global understanding. We thought global connectivity would make us more globally connected. And to an extent, that's been true. I'm still on Twitter, despite my trolls, in large part because of the things I've learned and the friends I've been able to make all over the world. And yet the nature of technology can be inherently depersonalizing and thus enable dehumanization. Of the over half of Americans who expect incivility to worsen in the coming years, nearly 7 in 10 blame the internet and social media for the current levels of nastiness in our culture. Are they right? In a 2016 study, Justin Cheng and a team of computer scientists at Stanford had 667 people take a test. Half the subjects took an easy test, while the other half took a really hard and frustrating version. Afterward, they all filled out surveys about their mood. Unsurprisingly, the people who had taken the hard test were in a foul mood. Then Cheng and his team had the subjects read an article, an abridged version of a column that argued that women should vote for Hillary Clinton instead of Bernie Sanders in the 2016 Democratic primaries. The subjects were told to post at least one note in the comments section that followed the article, which they were told would be visible to others. In each case, the subjects could already see three comments that had been posted. In some cases, those comments were neutral. In other cases, they were trolly. The subjects who took the easy test and then saw the neutral responses posted trolling comments 35% of the time. But among subjects who had either taken the hard test or seen the trolling comments, 50% then posted trolling comments. And among those who had experienced both the difficult test and the trolling comments, fully 68% turned into trolls. In other words, they were almost twice as likely to troll as the neutral group. In another experiment, researchers found that men who had lost an interactive video game were more likely to engage in misogynistic trolling of women who were also playing the game. Other research shows that individuals who have low self-esteem around their social identities are more likely to hold derogatory views about outgroups, and that hate crime perpetrators actually experience a temporary boost in self-esteem. Still, is there something about the way technology uniquely shapes our experience of ourselves and others that magnifies these effects? Yes, argues psychologist John Suler. Suler has pioneered what he calls the online disinhibition effect, the way in which the design of modern technology, including social media, seems to make people more inclined to self-disclose or act out more frequently or intensely than they would in person. Suler, a professor at Rider University in New Jersey, was one of the first academics to study how we represent and express ourselves online. His online disinhibition effect, based on his own experiences in the early days of the social web, has become one of the most influential analyses of online behavior. The question of why some people behave like jerks online first fascinated Suler about 20 years ago, when the internet was still in its relative infancy. In the late 1990s, he was involved online in something called The Palace, a sort of graphics-based chat room. I was in high school then and hung out in The Palace sometimes too. The thing I most remember is a moment when I sought out a lesbian-themed room so that I could ask a bunch of naive questions to some very patient smiley faces as I was sussing out my own identity. In that sense, for me, The Palace represented the best of what the internet had to offer, information and connectivity. But when Sula was in The Palace, he noticed people behaving differently than in real life, saying or doing things in this virtual community they probably would never otherwise contemplate. Sula also noticed the effect on himself. "I'm a much more talkative person online than I am in person," Sula tells me as we chatted over the phone one afternoon. "Being a clinical psychologist, I'm very introspective and I'm very much into censoring myself and being aware of what I'm doing as far as my clinical work." But he wasn't like that in The Palace. In fact, Suler even got involved in what he calls slightly deviant behavior, like playing pranks on newbies in the digital community. It was as though he acted like a different person online. I was fascinated by how people socialize online, particularly in this imaginary world where people have avatars to represent their identities, Suler says. Suler's online disinhibition effect has several parts. We're disinhibited online because we can hide from our real identities, what he calls dissociative anonymity. We don't actually see the people we're communicating with, and so we lose the normal cues of face-to-face interaction, invisibility. And there's a delay between when we write something and when someone reads it, asynchronicity, which also makes our online communication seem less like real life and therefore less connected to real-life consequences. In addition, everyone is supposed to be equal online, which means everyone is equally a potential target. Minimization of status and authority. You're not going to call a coworker an asshat because you could get fired or ostracized by your peers, but online, you don't have status to protect and no one has authority over you. The online world seems so different from the real world that we consciously or unconsciously believe that just like we're not our real selves online, neither is anyone else, that the internet is almost like a fictional realm. All of this explains why trolling and harassment are worse in spaces like Twitter, where we're often less visibly connected to and accountable to our family, friends, and colleagues, compared with platforms like Facebook and Instagram, which are generally more personal. I guess it's the whole anonymous thing. Nobody knows me, Linda Likes Bacon says when I ask her how she can be so mean in tweets. If I don't know you, I'm not going to spout off at you in person. That's just not me. But she'll do it on Twitter. It's kind of like hiding behind an anonymous wall, she says. You think you're just talking to yourself, Suler explains when I tell him what Linda Likes Bacon said. When you're talking to yourself, you're willing to say anything. Suler calls the tendency to believe we're talking to ourselves solipsistic introjection, by far my favorite part of his theory. It's a mental contortion that fascinates me. It turns out when we read what somebody else writes online, we don't picture them saying it, especially if it's someone we don't know. We instead experience their message as a voice within our own head, as if that person's psychological presence and influence have been assimilated or interjected into our own psyche. According to Suler, that other person actually becomes a projection of ourselves, of how we would feel in the situation, or at least how we believe that person we're writing to should be feeling. In other words, we're not considering their feelings. We're really thinking about our own. Suler compares the phenomenon to a novelist hearing characters in her head and then writing out the dialogue as she experiences it. The characters themselves are unreal. They're just in the writer's head. The problem is, on social media, these are actual human beings we're communicating with, yet perceiving as sort of versions of ourselves. Hence, in aggregate, the problem. In real life, I wouldn't be offensive to someone just to be mean or just for entertainment value, Linda Likes Bacon tells me. But she would online. Of course, we can't just simply blame the technology, but we have to acknowledge that technology is exacerbating the problem. What's the antidote? Suler says everyone needs to put yourself in the place of the other person online. But he adds, that's not always easy to do. Because you can't see people, you can't hear them, you may not know anything about their background or their identity. So it does take some well-prepared, well-tuned, empathic abilities to be online and to realize that these are other people at the end of these internet connections. That requires a deliberate, conscious approach. Susan Benesch, a lawyer and researcher who studies dangerous speech, from genocidal propaganda to hate speech on Twitter, has proposed one such model. Benesch calls her approach counterspeech. But since I prefer not to define the solution only in reference to the problem, I think of Benesch's strategy as connection speech. According to Benesch, with this approach, we can find ways to talk with one another, online or off, that facilitate deeper connection, empathy, and mutual humanity, instead of hate. When we encounter hate speech online, most of us either ignore it or fire back with more hate. Both are understandable impulses or even instincts. But Benesch argues for responding with expressions of empathy instead, which she has shown not only interrupts cycles of hate speech, but can positively transform interactions as well as people's beliefs. That's certainly what happened to Megan Phelps Roper, the granddaughter of Fred Phelps, one of the most notoriously and explicitly hateful people in modern U.S. history. Fred Phelps founded the Westboro Baptist Church. Maybe you've heard of it. It's the small extremist right-wing Christian hate group that protests the funerals of U.S. soldiers killed in action because Westboro members believe that military deaths are God's payback for the country's tolerance of gay rights. Westboro is probably best known for its signature slogan, God Hates Fags. As recounted in a New Yorker article by Adrian Chen in 2008, Megan created a Twitter account, and by 2009, she was regularly tweeting Westboro's messages of hate, like posting, "Thank God for AIDS" on World AIDS Day, and that sort of thing. Westboro members were known for picking targets most people would find sympathetic to pummel with hate. Megan was no exception. One day, Megan decided to target Jewlicious, a Twitter account belonging to David Abitbol, a Jerusalem-based blogger. She tweeted, "Finish the sentence. The only good Jew is a... repentant Jew!" and she tagged Julicious to make sure he would see it. He wrote back, "Thanks, Megan. That's handy, what with Yom Kippur coming up." Because, get it, Yom Kippur is the Holiday of Atonement. Megan replied with characteristically acerbic nastiness, and David tweeted back a wisecrack about Megan holding a sign reading, "God Hates Shrimp." Megan was trolling Julicious, plain and simple. She was vomiting hate through her keyboard and straight in his direction. And probably no one would have blamed him if he had thrown it right back at her. But he didn't. David took the high road and ended up taking Megan with him. David told the New Yorker that his express goal was to humanize a real Jew for Megan and her hateful clan. "I wanted to be, like, really nice, so they would have a hard time hating me," David said. For her part, Megan reflected, "I knew he was evil, but he was friendly." And somewhere in the space created by that "but," a sort of friendship bloomed. There were others who helped change her mind. Graham Hughes, a Canadian college student who interviewed Megan for a paper, started corresponding with her over Twitter. They didn't just talk politics. They talked about music. "I remember just thinking, how can somebody who appreciates good music believe so many hateful things?" Graham said. And when Graham was hospitalized for a brain infection, Megan acted more like a friend than many of Graham's real-life friends. "I knew there was a genuine connection between us," he told the New Yorker. "It was like I was becoming part of a community," Megan said of her emerging friendships on Twitter. "I was beginning to see them as human." The people Megan met through Twitter challenged her orthodoxies and humanized for her entire groups of people she'd been taught to hate. Eventually, in the fall of 2012, Megan left Westboro and, in effect, left most of her entire family as well. Afterward, one of the first places she went was to a Jewlicious festival hosted by David. It was his kindness and humor that had opened Megan up to a whole new way of thinking and, ultimately, to an entirely new life on the other side of hate. And imagine that. One of the first things the former anti-Semitic "God Hates Fags" activist did was go to a giant party with progressive Jews. All because of some exchanges on usually hate-spreading Twitter. How can we all learn to practice connection speech? In her writings for the Dangerous Speech Project, which she directs, Susan Benesch offers a great set of guidelines. The Twitter exchange that made Megan Phelps Roper begin to re-examine her views is an example of what Benesch calls golden conversations, which makes me think of golden showers. But I love Benesch's point. According to Benesch, a successful golden conversation online, or presumably in real life as well, shifts hateful discourse, and perhaps even beliefs, both for the person directly engaged in the hate speech as well as everyone else observing that speech as a bystander. It dovetails with the civil libertarian position that the answer to hate speech isn't curbing or infringing speech, but rather encouraging more speech, and in particular, constructive speech, that directly combats and undermines hate. Benesch provides a moving example of how powerful the practice can be. On Martin Luther King Day in 2015, Mr. Scrotum 21 posted on Twitter, "In honor of MLK Day today, I'm taking a vow to use the word nigger as many times as possible and in the most inappropriate times." A black writer named Ijeoma Oluo responded with a Martin Luther King Jr. quote, "Let no man pull you so low as to hate him." Mr. Scrotum 21 responded by attacking Ijeoma with increasingly racist insults. And each time, she responded with another King quote. They went back and forth like this for a while. Eventually, Mr. Scrotum 21 sarcastically tweeted, "I hope I get shot soon," pretending this was also a quote from Dr. King. Ijeoma responded, "I wish you peace and love and freedom from the hatred that hurts your heart." "Who's that quote from?" Mr. Scrotum 21 tweeted. "That's me," Ijeoma replied, "sending love and hope to you." Then Mr. Scrotum 21 trivialized the severity of violence against black Americans past and present, at which point Ijeoma accused Mr. Scrotum 21 of mocking murder. Mr. Scrotum 21 tweeted back, "Look, honey, I'm 14 years old. You need to chill." "My son is 13 years old," Ijeoma replied, "and he would never mock your murder." "Well, good for him. He must have a really cool mom," Mr. Scrotum 21 wrote. "He does," tweeted Ijeoma. "Does your mom know you spend your time on the internet trying to hurt people?" "I doubt it," Mr. Scrotum 21 replied. "She's been dead for a year and a half now." "I'm sorry for your loss, and I hope you find a better way to honor her," Ijeoma tweeted. They exchanged some more tweets. Mr. Scrotum 21 said a counselor had recommended tweeting to express grieving and help with healing. Igioma suggested journaling instead. Mr. Scrotum 21 alluded to depression. Igioma mentioned that people on the other end of Mr. Scrotum 21's tweets might be suffering from depression, too. "Well, I wish you luck," Igioma wrote toward the end of their exchange, "and I hope you will try to refrain from hurting others while you try to heal." "You are so nice, and I'm so sorry," Mr. Scrotum 21 replied. "Thank you," Igioma wrote. "Today is about forgiveness. People do shitty things when they are hurting. Send me a message if you need to talk." My friend, writer Amina Tao So, has cautioned that there is a compounding unfairness, even oppression, in expecting the most marginalized among us to take the high road. "Why is it black women are always asked to do the work?" Amina Tao chides one day as we're in a cab and I'm telling her about my book. "Once you're provoked, the rules of engagement change," she adds. "I can fucking kill you and I'm justified in doing that, metaphorically speaking." I don't have a good answer. There is something inherently unjust in suggesting that the burden to turn the other cheek should so often fall on those who have been hit the hardest. Certainly, I understand that resistance. But I also understand that if we keep waiting for the most privileged among us to make the first move, we may be waiting forever. In the face of so much violence, it was the marginalized in India and the United States and elsewhere who took up the mantle of nonviolence. And maybe it wasn't fair, but it was effective. Obviously, I have a strong bias against violence and intolerance and hate, no matter the source. And it's for that reason I hope that even in the darkest moments and corners of the world, including those of the Internet, we can all be more like Igioma Oluo. It's the possibility of such healing conversations that gives me hope, not only for Twitter, but for humanity. I've had my own experiments and small victories with connection speech. In particular, I favor Susan Benesch's strategy of humor, which she's found to be one of the most effective connection speech tactics. It sure worked when I joked about Jack's Back 100's hate tweets, if you consider his flirtation a sign of success. And every time someone makes some wisecrack about me looking like Justin Bieber, of course I joke about it. Like what? Being compared to a hunky international pop star is an insult? Benesch writes that humorous connection speech is especially potent in neutralizing hateful or dangerous speech that might otherwise be viewed as powerful or intimidating. These days, I'm less depressed or horrified by my trolls, and instead I see them, or try to see them, as somewhere between sad and amusing opportunities for engagement. That's not to say trolling is amusing. In fact, it can be psychologically harmful, and online threats can quickly turn into real-life concerns for safety. Sadly, I've become so accustomed to trolling that I can forget this. Faced with truly dangerous trolls, just being nice cannot and should not be the answer. We need to respond to threats and safety issues swiftly and seriously online and off. But fortunately, most trolls aren't dangerous. They're just mean. That doesn't mean we have to be mean, too. We can choose connection speech instead. Personally, because I've chosen connection speech, I'm less fazed by my trolls now, and I drink less, too. Instead, I take them in stride. I style my hair with the spittle of my trolls. I also see them as opportunities to practice my humanity and, hopefully, character by character, to expand theirs. Connection speech, with Benesch's research supporting it, offers a ray of hope in the dark storm cloud that is Internet vitriol, and vitriol in general. Because the fact is, we all say we don't like this crap. For instance, most Americans say they don't like mudslinging political ads and negative campaigns. And yet we keep voting for the mudslingers. Ads that ran in August of the 2016 presidential campaign were more negative than ads that ran in August of the 2012 campaign. And while about two-thirds of Hillary Clinton's campaign ads were negative, almost all of Donald Trump's ads were negative. He didn't air a single positive ad. And look who won. Do we really want what we say we want? If so, we have to start actually supporting it and modeling civility ourselves, both online and off. If we stop fanning hate and instead practice connection speech, that little ray of hope for a better way of interacting and even disagreeing with one another could spread. Hell, it could go viral. But even basking in the hopeful rays of connection speech, I still wonder if there's a larger, even darker cloud hovering over us. Sure, maybe we can mitigate a little hate here and there. But is the core problem inevitable? Is hate some inescapable social or biological imperative that we can only hope to staunch but never fully stop? Thankfully, I learned that no, Hate is no more compulsory than my pessimism. But both are profoundly powerful bad habits. Chapter 2. How We Hate, the Former Terrorist. I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense, once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain. James Baldwin. Bassam Aramin has a smile so broad that it reaches to his earlobes, and he speaks so softly that you can't help but want to lean closer to him and capture every word. You'd never think he was a convicted terrorist. While internet trolling is a relatively new form of hate, in the Middle East, hate seems almost synonymous with history. The tiny slip of land known as Israel today, and Palestine before that, could have been a global symbol for harmony, a place first inhabited by peaceful Arab farmers and then by Jews desperate for peace. And yet today, the land I'll call Israel-Palestine is an epicenter of acrimony, which not only defines the region, but grips the globe. For many Jewish people and their allies, violent attacks against Israel echo the harrowing history of the Holocaust and anti-Semitism more broadly. For many Palestinians and their allies, the atrocities of Israel represent the original sin of the West, settler colonialism and oppression, rooted in Islamophobia. Both sides think the other overwhelmingly guilty, and their own side relatively innocent. But what most everyone agrees on is that the hate is so historical and hardened that it's almost hopeless to think it can be solved. Fortunately, not everyone has given up hope. I first heard Bassam's story through a friend who told me how the former terrorist had eventually renounced violence against Israelis and, in 2005, founded Combatants for Peace, a group made up of Palestinians who'd engaged in violence against Israelis, plus former Israeli soldiers, all now working together to promote understanding between the two sides. Today, Combatants for Peace has about 600 members. The group regularly stages nonviolent rallies, holds meetings where former combatants share their perspectives and victims of violence tell their stories, sponsors tours of the West Bank for Israelis, and rebuilds playgrounds in the territories that have been demolished by Israeli security forces. Any story about a former terrorist now working for peace would probably have caught my attention. But in the context of Israel-Palestine, Bassam's story especially stood out. I thought that if I wanted to understand more about how hate is entrenched in human experience past and present, Israel-Palestine would be a good place to visit. And if I wanted to understand how to transform that hate into its opposite, Bassam would be a good person to talk with. I first met Bassam for coffee in the lobby of a Comfort Inn on the west side of Manhattan when he was in town for a Combatants for Peace fundraiser. I guess I was expecting some sort of enlightened Buddhist type who would talk to me about the balance and subjectivity of the universe between meditative breaths. Instead, I meet a chain smoker with a prominent limp and a wry sense of humor. When Bassam shares the story of his childhood, I am hooked. He was born in a cave on the outskirts of Hebron in the West Bank in 1968, the year after the Six-Day War in which Israel defeated Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian forces and started occupying the West Bank, which had until then been part of Jordan. Like many families in the region, Bassam's lived in the mountains and farmed the surrounding territory. They were a large bunch, eventually including 15 children, some of them Bassam's step-siblings from his father's marriage to his first wife, who had passed away. I find myself picturing the cave with some sort of boho chic vibe of fabric-draped minimalist wood furniture and strands of white Christmas tree lights crisscrossing the ceiling, like a place Vogue might stage a photo shoot about hot new neo-colonialist look. I catch myself, realizing that I'm trivializing, even romanticizing Bassam's childhood to the point of being patronizing. When I later visit Bassam in the West Bank, I experience viscerally that there was nothing romantic about his youth, or about the poverty and violence still afflicting so many children in the territory all these years later. Bassam's earliest memory is of Israeli soldiers coming into his family's cave. When he was around 5 years old, a helicopter landed nearby. "For me, it was something unbelievable," Bassam says, almost in a whisper. "Come from the sky." You can still hear his childlike awe. Soldiers climbed down from the helicopter. They were from the Israeli Defense Forces, which Israelis and Palestinians alike call the IDF. "They came to the cave, these soldiers," Bassam tells me. "Very scary." His mother, his grandmother, and an older cousin were in the cave too. The cousin was just 15. "But for me," Bassam says, "he was a huge man." The soldiers talked to Bassam's family for a few minutes, and then suddenly, one of them slapped Bassam's cousin across the face. Then the IDF left. Bassam was confused and terrified, by their sudden invasion and inexplicable aggression. As he tells me the story, my mind slips to the narrative I was taught in my childhood, which often portrayed hateful, violence-prone Palestinians who must be controlled lest another Holocaust break out. Again, I catch myself. I realize how conditioned I am to search for a justification, a reasonable explanation for the soldiers' behavior. Like a good progressive Jew, I can recite the facts about how Israel occupies the land of Bassam's community and acts out that occupation in daily brutal ways that are part of a system of oppression. But even so, I figure something must have happened to justify the idea of hitting his cousin. He must have deserved it on some level. Sort of like assuming that people who get pulled over by cops a lot must have done something to deserve it. Those of us who aren't subject to biased mistreatment often rationalize the mistreatment as justified. I would soon learn, when I visited the West Bank, to challenge that assumption. When Bassam was 7, he tells me, his family moved to the town nearby in order to cut down on what had been an hour-long journey each way to school and back. Then he started seeing Israeli soldiers all the time. They were a constant presence in the village. When he was 12 years old, the IDF shot and killed a young Palestinian girl near Bassam's village. A protest march was organized in response. Curious, Bassam waded into the crowd. The demonstration was illegal. It's actually been illegal since the occupation began for Palestinians to protest anything. And the IDF quickly cracked down on the march. I hear that childlike astonishment in Bassam's voice again as he describes the IDF soldiers coming out of nowhere, just like they did that day in his family's cave. "Israelis came from the sky," Bassam says. "You don't understand where they came from." Bassam says the soldiers threw tear gas canisters, and the villagers started screaming and scrambling in all directions. "I found myself running in the middle of the soldiers," he recounts. "One of them hit me on the back, the other hit me in the eye. I fell down." He remembers lying on the ground, dust and fear swirling around him, thinking to himself, "They're going to shoot me, and I'm going to die." I try to imagine how terrifying it would be as a 12-year-old to be lying on the street thinking you were about to be killed, but honestly, I can't. I was so sheltered and fortunate at that age, and I have been ever since. Bassam managed to half-walk, half-crawl to safety, inching between the legs of the soldiers to the other side of the crowd near where his home was. As he emerged, his hands and knees covered with stones and grit, he saw a young Palestinian standing on a hill holding a rock. Bassam guessed maybe he was 18 or 19 years old, the same age, by the way, as most of the IDF soldiers who were required to serve in the military at that age. To hear Bassam tell it, there was no way the young man and his small rock could have hurt the heavily armed Israeli security forces. But still, as Bassam emerged from the crowd, the soldiers shot the young man on the hill. "I saw him," Bassam says. "He died." His voice is unemotional, matter of fact, perhaps, from a lifetime of suffering. Bassam learned to hate the IDF. And as I listen to him, I can imagine how I would have learned to hate them, too. That hate makes sense. It seems rational, even justified. Which is what makes it so incredible that Bassam would eventually reject hate. Bassam now says peace will never be achieved unless enough people on both sides stop engaging in what conflict scholars call competitive victimhood, each seeing themselves as the worst victims in a situation that actually hurts everyone. "I'm not a victim," Bassam tells me. "No one can occupy me because I have peace within myself, in my heart." How could someone go from being convicted of terrorism for trying to kill Israelis to such an enlightened perspective? Maybe he's not a Buddhist scholar, but Bassam clearly has plenty to teach me. When our short time at the Comfort Inn is up, I've barely scratched the surface of his story, and I ask if I can come visit him in the West Bank. He flashes a sheepish smile at me and says, "Of course." So off I go. I had long avoided traveling to Israel-Palestine. I grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, amidst a decent-sized Jewish community, which meant we had Orthodox Jews and Reform Jews and everyone in between. Some of Allentown's Jews walked to synagogue every Saturday. Some of us dropped out of Hebrew school when we were 11 years old and barely ever set foot in a synagogue again. But within the diversity of what it meant to be a Jew, one thing was consistent in Allentown. We all supported Israel. Even today, I know Jews who eat pork and put up Christmas trees, but I don't know any Jews who oppose the existence of Israel. But what it means to support Israel has been changing, including among American Jews. The universal lockstep defense of Israel I experienced in my youth has given way to a more complicated landscape of perspectives, with many Jews and allies still supporting Israel while trying to balance the rights of Israelis with the rights of Palestinians. As a young adult, I was constantly approached with offers of free birthright trips to Israel, sponsored by Jewish groups with unilaterally pro-Israel agendas, and I always turned them down, figuring that visiting Israel was a tacit endorsement of the country's superior position in the conflict. Now I was ready to make the trip. In addition to visiting Bassam, I would more widely tour the occupied territories and spend time in Israel as well, interviewing both Palestinians and Israelis to try and get multiple perspectives. Before I went to the Middle East, I brushed up on the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and also read social science on the dynamics of what are called intractable conflicts. In particular, I delved into the concept of competitive victimhood, which Bassam had opened my eyes to, and discovered the work of Israeli psychologist Daniel Bartal. "Very often both sides believe that they are the victim," writes Bartal with his colleagues in a paper on competitive victimhood. "The struggle over the status of the sole victim can enhance aggressiveness and lead to the employment of harsher means against the rival outgroup. It's related to scapegoating, where one group perceives that its problems are the result of the other, even if the group being scapegoated is in fact the group that is suffering more than and even because of the other. This is how we have a dynamic in the United States today, in which Christian conservatives claim they are being oppressed by the nation's incremental progress toward queer rights, despite the reality that, over decades, it was the disproportionate power and influence of those same Christian conservatives that kept basic rights from queer people. And that actually still do. It is legal for same-sex couples to marry, but still also legal in most states to fire someone for being gay or gender nonconforming. Yet the sense of competitive victimhood keeps the tension brewing, including, yes, smears from the gay community against Christian conservatives. Each side literally makes the other side suffer more to express anger over how much their side is suffering, which is ridiculous, but there you have it. Bartal has focused his entire academic career on how to end deep-seated conflicts, and he identifies this dynamic of competitive victimhood as one of the main obstacles. It's at the heart of so many clashes all around the world, such as those between Indians and Pakistanis over the disputed territory of Kashmir, and between Turks and Kurds in Turkey. It was at play in the decades of the Troubles in Northern Ireland and in the horrors of the Bosnian genocide committed by Serbs. It's also a driving force in many long-brewing political battles in the U.S. between anti-abortion and pro-choice activists, gun control and gun rights advocates, and anti-globalization activists and corporatist defenders of the so-called inexorable march of globalization. We all think we're suffering worse, and then feel justified in marginalizing those we believe are not suffering or even causing our own suffering. For instance, studies show that bullies experience higher than average shame about their own shortcomings. And competitive victimhood also helps explain why, according to polls, a majority of white Americans perceive that they are more victimized than black Americans. We divide ourselves up into in-groups and out-groups, and then think our group has it worse. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is, of course, a textbook case of competitive victimhood. Palestinians generally think they suffer the most because of Israelis, and Israelis think they suffer the most because of Palestinians. In fact, I've talked to people on both sides of the conflict who think the idea that the other side suffers at all is preposterous. For instance, Palestinians generally articulate a version of history in which they were a peaceful people until they were invaded by Zionists who resorted to terrorism in their colonial conquest, including the bombing of Palestinian Arab civilians in 1938, the car bomb detonated by Zionists inside Jerusalem in 1947, and the Zionist slaughtering of the people of the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin in 1948. At the same time, many Israelis dwell on a version of history in which Jews are a constantly persecuted people who merely sought solace from repeated and extended acts of world terrorism only to be victimized by Palestinians, for instance, in the Arab riots during the 1920s, the Palestinian Arab revolt in the 1930s, and the Palestinian riots in Jerusalem in 1947. To some, Jews have used their historic oppression as an excuse to oppress others. And the State of Israel is itself a terrorist organization premised on settler colonialism that now holds all the power. To others, Palestinian criticism of Israel reflects the inherent anti-Semitism on the part of Muslims, just as suicide bombings reflect their inherent and unresolvable inhumanity toward others. These biases even shape both sides' perceptions of the same events. On December 30, 1947, Zionist militants threw two bombs into a crowd of Arab workers at the Haifa oil refinery. Six Arabs were killed. That afternoon, Arab protesters broke into the refinery and killed 39 Jews. The next day, a precursor force to the IDF fired on the Palestinian Arab village of Balad al-Sheikh while the residents were asleep. As many as 70 Palestinians were killed. Which attack was worse? Which attack was more justified? And do they all reflect hate? The litany of such attacks and counterattacks could fill a book of its own. Incidentally, I don't think it's anti-Israel to point out the oppressive nature of the current Israeli state, just like I don't think it's anti-Palestinian to point out the horrors of suicide bombings. What I do think is that if each act of violence is seen as justified retaliation for a previous act of violence, which itself is a retaliation for some previous act of violence, any objective truth becomes buried in the blur of rationalizations. These perceptions have snowballed through decades into a rationale for enduring hate and into justifications of horrifying violence perpetrated by both sides, some of which Bartel tells me he experienced firsthand while serving in the IDF. What makes competitive victimhood so pernicious in intractable conflicts and in general is that whatever side you're on, your arguments for being the worst victim and blaming the other side seem so rational. Of course, hate isn't rational, but it feels rational, and therefore feels justified. That's why we keep doing it. It's not that we're irrational. Our hate is a rational reaction to our often one-sided and deeply biased perceptions, which is why Bassam felt perfectly rational and justified when he attempted to kill Israeli soldiers. I had hoped Bassam would take me to the cave where his family lived, but the journey would have involved several hours of treacherous hiking, and Bassam has a severe limp from surviving polio as an infant. When he walks, his left leg suddenly buckles inward at the ankle, and it's as though his whole leg is starting to crumble, threatening to topple him entirely. He does, however, take me on a tour of the other sites of his youth, beginning at the home where he spent the remainder of his childhood, a modest cement square in the middle of a tangle of dusty streets and small cinder block homes. There's a large pile of rocks abutting the house, which Bassam tells me are the remnants of the room his father first built for the family. The rest of the house was constructed around them over time as the original room crumbled. There's rebar poking out from the rocks this way and that, with some soda cans hanging from the ends, like a development project turned into a modernist sculpture. He also shows me the hill where the young Palestinian he saw, shot, had been standing, and the buildings where his friends threw grenades at the IDF. "You never conceive of yourself as a terrorist," Bassam tells me. He uses the word terrorist now, but would never have back then. I ask, how would he have described himself then? As a freedom fighter? Not only a freedom fighter, Bassam replies, puffing out his small chest. We are the most humane freedom fighters on the earth. Why? Because we are against militants who try to kill us and occupy our land and our people, and we need to kill them for humanity, not for ourselves. It's justified, he adds. It's justified? I ask. You know it's wrong. No, it's not wrong, he says, conveying to me his mindset when he was a teenager devoted to killing Israelis. Just like the terrorists Elena Duffy interrogated and Ahmed Yala interviewed. They thought what they were doing was right. Bassam formed a sort of unofficial gang with four of his friends, who were basically juvenile troublemakers in a politicized landscape. Back then, for instance, it was against the law to have a Palestinian flag, let alone display it. So Bassam and his friends would use old bits of fabric to stitch together haphazard versions of the flag. We started our terrorism by raising the Palestinian flag on the trees around our school, says Bassam. This was a combat mission to us. Why? Because the soldiers, when they came to the village and they see a flag, they were crazy. They did everything to put it down. They shoot it until it's burned. The little gang also scrawled graffiti against Jews because it drove the IDF soldiers crazy. For Bassam and his friends, Jews and Israelis were synonymous, and the only members of either group they'd ever encountered were the heavily armed IDF soldiers who yelled at them in a language they didn't understand. Bassam's anti-IDF activities grew from there. Then one day, he and his friends found a crate of unexploded Jordanian grenades in the mountains. They decided to use them to try to kill Israeli soldiers. Bassam was in full support. In fact, he wanted to throw one of the grenades himself, but his limp was the problem. Since he couldn't keep up, his friends said Bassam had to stay behind or he would slow them down if they had to escape. So when his gang of friends perched on a low roof in the village to attack an Israeli military convoy, Bassam wasn't anywhere near them. One of his friends pulled the pin and tossed the grenade. But since they were only kids with no training on how grenades worked and no internet to look such things up on, they missed their target. The grenade exploded a good distance from the convoy. No one was hurt. Immediately after the attack, the Israeli military raided every home in the village and interrogated the residents. Bassam's family had no idea he was involved, and the police didn't know either. They were just rounding up people at random to interrogate and abuse. His brother Jamal, who is 3 years older than Bassam, watched from his grandfather's house as the IDF started its sweep. Jamal tells me he saw the soldiers beating random people with sticks. Eventually, the IDF raided their grandfather's house, too, and beat Jamal, Bassam's older brothers, and their uncle before hauling them off to jail, where they beat them more. Bassam wasn't there. He was hiding with his friends. When he finally got back home and saw Bassam, Jamal told his little brother, "I want to catch this criminal who threw that hand grenade." Jamal, too, hated the Israelis, but he also hated whoever the dumb Palestinian was who threw the grenade. "Yes," Bassam agreed. "Me too. If I meet him, I will kill him." Then a few days later, Bassam's friends threw a second grenade at the IDF. It also missed its targets. Bassam was disappointed. He and his friends, Bassam tells me, seriously wanted to kill Israelis. They weren't manipulated by adults into throwing the grenades, nor were they naive about how deadly the weapons could be. They wanted to inflict severe, painful, and total suffering. About a year later, in 1985, when Bassam was 17 years old, one of the members of Bassam's gang was arrested for something else and ended up confessing to the Israeli police about the grenades. Bassam and the others were immediately arrested. Despite the fact that he hadn't been there when the grenades were thrown, and no one was killed or even injured, Bassam was sent to prison to serve a 7-year sentence for committing terrorism. His friends received longer sentences, 14, 15, 19, and 21 years. It's important to note here that the 1999 United Nations Treaty, the International Convention for the Suppression of the Financing of Terrorism, defines a terrorist act as one intended to cause death or serious bodily injury to a civilian or to any other person not taking active part in the hostilities in a situation of armed conflict. Israel signed this treaty in 2000. Under this definition, what Bassam and his friends did isn't technically terrorism. They were trying to attack a military convoy, not civilians. But terrorism is the word Bassam uses to describe his own acts. It's also the way his offenses were described in the charges brought against him. But his trial was conducted in Hebrew, which Bassam didn't speak at the time, so he couldn't understand what was happening. It wasn't until years later, when Bassam was applying for a travel visa, that he saw case files from his conviction. As Bassam tells it, the charging papers said he had put the Israeli civilians in dangerous situations, even though there weren't any Israeli civilians for miles around the attack, just IDF soldiers. Was this mischaracterization by the Israeli prosecution a deliberate lie, or an unconscious example of what psychologist Robert Sternberg calls stories of hate, which we, eventually over time, unquestioningly believe? After all the mental hurdles that get us to hate, Sternberg explains, that hate ends up becoming a simplified, one-sided story we tell ourselves over and over again, to the point where our biased retelling becomes more powerful in our minds than actual truth, which in turn makes it harder to take in examples or evidence that counter our story, so our own version just keeps getting more deeply reinforced. And thus, we all rewrite history to make ourselves and our group the besieged good guy, bravely standing against the evil enemy. Terrorists do this too. The reality is that terrorism is not the province of purely irrational, innately hateful people, whose somehow preternatural evil existence is distinct from our own. It's tempting to believe that. Demonizing others as irreparably evil both reinforces the fragile sense of our own inherent goodness and justifies a host of aggressive attitudes or actions against those others, to which our own moral standards would otherwise object. In other words, demonizing others reinforces our own narrative, in which we are the victims of those evildoers, and thus justifies hate and violence against them. But what if we're all victims, and to some extent, perpetrators of hate? And what if pointing fingers and hating each other isn't just wrong, but counterproductive? Specifically, the struggle against terrorism has been hobbled by the common belief that terrorists are psychopaths. Of course, some terrorists probably are, in fact, psychopaths, literally lacking the capacity to empathize with and care for others. But psychopaths are estimated to make up just 1% of the population. Discussing his book on psychopathy, writer John Ronson cited research that found you're 4 times more likely to find a psychopath at the top of the corporate ladder than you are walking around the janitor's office. Also, psychopaths, by definition, don't feel remorse, whereas many terrorists feel justified in their terrorism due to the suffering of their loved ones and community. Terrorism specialist Bruce Hoffman writes of terrorists, "Rather than the wild-eyed fanatics or crazed killers that we have been conditioned to expect, many are in fact highly articulate and extremely thoughtful individuals for whom terrorism is, or was, an entirely rational choice, often reluctantly embraced, and then only after considerable reflection and debate." That some Palestinians choose to express their political views through violence, and suicide bombings in particular, is, in context, neither irrational nor desperate, but rational and calculated, writes Bruce Hoffman. Palestinians view such attacks as the only way to convince Israeli decision-makers that the Palestinian people will never yield to coercion. In the Middle East, perceived context in which suicide bombers and supporters express themselves include a collective sense of historical injustice, political subservience, as well as countervailing religious hope, writes cognitive anthropologist Scott Atran. Addressing such perceptions does not entail accepting them as simple reality. However, ignoring the causes of these perceptions risks misidentifying causes and solutions for suicide bombing. In other words, we don't have to accept the suicide bomber's stories or perceptions as objectively real, but we do have to deal with the reality that they believe them, and ideally, the conditions that cause those perceptions too. At the same time, this supposedly rational calculus feeds an equally rational reaction on the part of Israelis to perceive the Palestinians as inherently and inexorably violent. Of course, Palestinians think that Israelis are the ones with the entrenched institutional violence problem. If we can fulfill our goals without violence, we will do so, Mahmoud al-Zahar, co-founder of Hamas, told a reporter in 1995, just after the first Intifada, a spate of violent uprisings and attacks in Palestinian territories. Violence is a means, not a goal. Yet the violence committed by both Palestinians and Israelis for decades, whichever you think is worse, has only led to more violence and, in turn, to more justifications for claiming victimhood. The mind-changing truth is that my time with Bassam Aramin and others in the region helped me to see that the real reason we have such a persistent problem with hate is that we all do it, and we all believe that our hate is justified. The vast majority of people who hate, even extremists who commit violence in the name of hate, are ordinary people who also love and worry and fear and care and who can point to a number of what to them feel like well-justified reasons for their hatred. We don't just hate for the sake of hating. We hate because we feel under siege, and hate is our response. That's as true of terrorists as it is of bullies. After giving me a tour of the village, Bassam takes me to a nice white stone McMansion sort of house on a hill that belongs to his brother Jamal. Sitting in the receiving room, a formal space just off the entrance where guests are entertained, with comfy overstuffed couches and a taupe and red plush carpet with flecks of gold thread, I'm confused. I figure that the late-night raids Palestinians keep telling me go on almost every night throughout the West Bank, where the IDF shows up unannounced, bangs on the door and ransacks the house, and sometimes even takes over the house for a few hours or a few days to turn it into a military outpost. That doesn't happen in a nice house like this, right? So I ask Bassam's brother whether his home has ever been raided. Of course, Jamal answers in a straightforward way, as if I'd just asked for another cup of tea. But, I'm thinking, not often, right? When was the last time, I ask. 3 days ago, in the middle of the night, Jamal answers, again nonchalantly. Israeli soldiers pounded on the door and inspected the home at 2 in the morning, apparently for no other reason than to disturb the sleep and sense of security of this 52-year-old man and his wife. They weren't suspected of crime, let alone of an unpaid electric bill. But a former Israeli soldier I spoke with said the main purpose of the raids, as it was explained to him during training, is just to make our presence felt. Later, my Palestinian translator suggests I cross the separation wall between the West Bank into Jerusalem by going on foot through the Calandia checkpoint. Like Jamal's home, much of the West Bank feels surprisingly normal, in spite of all the scary hype I'd heard as a kid. Cities like Ramallah and Hebron are filled with busy shopping streets and cute little cafes that could easily be mistaken for parts of downtown Brooklyn. Sure, I noticed the ridiculously potholed streets and the fact that there are gleaming Israeli settlements in the middle of impoverished Palestinian villages, but I'm really not aware that I'm in a conflict-ridden, militarized, occupied territory until I try to leave. The Times of Israel newspaper has called the Calandia checkpoint the region's most infamous crossing. I shuffle through one full-body turnstile and then another, from one metal cage into another, like a cow in a stockyard. In another cage, I wait for a faceless voice to press a button so the group I'm with can go through yet another full-body turnstile and show our papers to an agent behind bulletproof glass, then put our belongings on a scanner, then wait for another turnstile, and then another before we can finally exit. It's more than inconvenient. I feel dislocated and resentful. It's midday, and it's not even crowded, yet the whole process is claustrophobic and intimidating, and to move a distance of what amounts to about 400 yards takes 16 minutes. And I don't have to do this every single day in a land where my ancestors were once free. The quintessential Palestinian experience, which illustrates some of the most basic issues raised by Palestinian identity, writes Columbia University history professor Rashid Khalid.